This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, May 6th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee for president, is working on how to handle the wrath of certain powerful members of the party. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham on Face the Nation this week.
And I think Hillary Clinton is an incredibly flawed candidate, but she will mop the floor with Donald Trump because with women and Hispanics, they hate Donald Trump because he's so harsh and he's so cruel in his foreign and his policies toward illegal immigration, and he's so insulting toward women in general. The Republican Party, if we embrace Donald Trump, you're rejecting conservatism for Trumpism, which is a cult of a strong man that absolutely is nowhere near conservatism.
Jill Lepore joins me to discuss what history may have to teach us about Trumpism and other forms of popular revolt. Hi, Jill. Welcome.
Hey, Dorothy.
Do you find Donald Trump as dangerous as Lindsey Graham does? This is not a new phenomenon in American politics, and maybe you could remind us when and why these moments of nativism come to the fore.
I think one of the tricky things with Trump and with journalists actually asking historians what to make of Trump is that one of the things I think historians are asked to do is come up with a character who's just as outsized and larger than life and in the American past and from whom we can draw sort of immediate lessons, like Trump is to William Jennings Bryant as Carter was to, you know, what it's like an SAT analogy test or something. And history just doesn't work that way. I mean, you can't pluck people out of the past and set them down in the present as if there's sort of so many color forms and you just change the background and you move people around. But you can look at the kind of larger story of American history and trace, I think, elements of continuity that are helpful, not so much in answering the question, are we about to fall off a cliff, but how did we get to where we actually stand right now? What is the ground underneath our feet? In that way, you know, what people are alarmed about with Trump are many things, but one thing is the violent tenor of his nativism that is just all but calling for beating people up. Not just saying these people don't belong in this country, but these people should be hated for being here. And the degree to which Trump is inciting violence. If you think of the long sweep of American history, there's a long tradition of nativism in the American past. It's really that era, atypical era in American history that many people think to be typical, which runs from the end of the Second World War through the early to mid-1970s, an era marked by great economic prosperity, by relative economic equality and income equality in the United States, certainly relative to what came before and what's come since, by low political polarizations. There are a lot of things that political scientists and historians now know about this unusual period in the middle of the 20th century, against which most of us measure the contemporary moment. Like, that's the America that was great, and we're going to make America great again. But that actually was an unusual period in the American past.
Many are saying that this could be the end of the Republican Party, much in the way the Whig Party collapsed in 1854. Actually, Graham calls this an internal civil war.
Yeah, well, parties rise and fall, and that's not the end of the world. I mean, that's a healthy thing about party systems. It's not pleasant to be in the middle of it, certainly if you're a partisan. It's not pleasant to see your party be divided and fall apart. I do think that there's something different going on in this election in that both parties are, I think, quite deeply divided. And that's different, because usually when the nation is undergoing a party realignment, it's one party that's shifting. So this is unusual. But it's the kind of thing where if you read the accounts from different moments in the past when parties have undergone a realignment, you see a lot of people saying, oh, no, we're not going to have parties anymore. And they're always wrong. So, I mean, yeah, the party system could be falling apart, but there's not really any historical evidence to support that.
Is it possible to look at the Trump phenomenon and the Bernie Sanders phenomenon as a kind of cathartic expression of Democratic forces at work?
You know, I've been waiting to see if anyone would quote John Adams from 1814 when he said, there was never a democracy yet that did not commit suicide.
Wow. <I'm>
I was just rereading this Christopher Lash book from, I think it's from 1995, The Revolt of the Elites. Do you remember this
book?
Yeah, and I don't find myself agreeing with Lash that often, but I happened to pull it off the shelf and said, oh, well, is he saying it's going to happen again? And everything that he predicts in that book more or less has happened. He talks about the party system and party elites separating from the masses. And this is, so it's also the revolt of the intellectual elite that pays no attention to ordinary people anymore. But there's a lot of attention paid by Lash in that book to the alienation of the press, from the people. There's sort of a kind of nostalgia for the time when the beat gumshoe reporter didn't go to college, was, you know, maybe a high school graduate, maybe not, worked in the printing trades, worked his way up to the news desk with a long stop as a police reporter, and hung out with people in bars and taverns and corners. And the man on the street interview was how that reporter figured out what Americans were thinking about politics and who they might vote for, and that kind of reporting makes democracy possible. And when we think about the necessity of a free press in a democracy, that's the kind of reporting that we're talking about. When you think about the kind of reporting that has en masse characterized the coverage of this election, you have the kind of instant Twitter insult feed, and you have the poll-driven number, 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 number prediction story. You don't really have the man on the street anymore. In fact, I mean, I think, at least insofar as I read my history of journalism, that became something that people were quite contemptuous of. The idea that you would go around, walk around and talk to people because, you know, the anecdote is not data.
And this is the one thing that you have to give Donald Trump credit for. He did understand what no one in the party elite seemed to understand, that ordinary voters were thinking about different things. They were worried about their own lives.
Yeah, and there are a lot of truisms that he revealed to be not true at all, like that in a primary you'd have to appeal to evangelicals to win over the Republican base. That's just apparently not true. I don't mean to laugh off the phenomenon. I mean, I think it's a really important election. I think there are great political questions at stake. I mean, other than Sanders' call for campaign finance and Trump's indirect assertion that campaign funding is corrupt, often a direct assertion, you know, where are the calls for reforms of the democratic process except, oh, wait, don't switch around the rules of the convention such that they make it more difficult for my candidate to ride in at the last moment? Why isn't anybody calling for a congressional investigation into the polling industry? There's a lot of really interesting ways that this could generate an important set of conversations.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So getting back to the question of the possible future or possible end of the Republican Party, Ben Sasse, who's a freshman senator from Nebraska, quite right-wing, he's in the kind of high hortatory mode, says that he may withdraw from the party rather than support Trump, be saying that he signed up for the party of Abraham Lincoln, not the party of David Duke, which raises the question about what is left these days of the party of Lincoln or of Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, or George H.W. Bush, for that matter.
Oh, that's purely rhetoric, the party of Lincoln.
It is. It
hasn't been the party of Lincoln since Lincoln was assassinated.
And it was a very different party.
It's awkward, I think, for Republicans whose intellectual move is about tradition over change.
Yes.
To accept that their party is itself the product of continuous change and that this is yet more change. But Trump isn't very allied to the party. I mean, not even as its leader, he won't be allied to
the party. Well, he's not really a Republican, as many Republicans love to point out. What about candidates who have broken off and formed third parties? I was thinking this morning about Teddy Roosevelt, who created the Progressive Party in 1912, which didn't turn out remotely as he'd hoped it would.
I really think it would be exciting if someone would pull a third party run at this point, just for the sake of demonstrating that it can be done in this part of our political tradition. And I think, you know, Sanders gave an interview today with NPR in which he said he's not pulling out. He thinks it's good for the party for him to stay in. Well, he isn't really part of the party either.
No.
There could be a lot of shenanigans in the next few months, and I think it may be bad for the presidency, but it's good for the democracy.
You've written before about the tradition of maligning powerful women, which has a very, very long history, going back to Mary Tudor, to name one. So in that sense, Trump has been sounding a kind of a tired old theme when he said the other day that if Hillary were a man, she'd get 5% of the vote. How far have we advanced, say, since Elizabeth Dole ran for president in 2000?
No, we haven't advanced at all. That's why I think this is such an interesting election, because it brings everything out onto the front porch that was really hanging out on the back porch. And I think that's really important. I mean, I made the comparison, and this was not meant by way of an analogy, but purely as an illustration, to the Lincoln-Douglas fight in 1860, which was a revisiting of the debates that they held in 1858. It has nothing in common with this election, and that neither of these people is anywhere near the political stature, has the rhetorical skills of either of these candidates. But that election was really important, the debates in 58 and the election in 1860, because the question really had not been fully batted about in the public square. I mean, what Stephen Douglas of Illinois said was the Declaration of Independence was written for white men and their posterity forever. And what Lincoln said was, no, it's meant to include everybody. And that debate really, really needed to happen and needed to be squarely addressed, as ugly as it was. And as ugly as this upcoming debate, presumably between Clinton and Trump, will be, it is really a question about who belongs in the United States and who belongs in office in the United States. People need to stop sort of whispering about that and muttering about that on their back porch and sit on their front porch and have an argument with their next-door neighbor about it. And that's an urgent conversation.
And do you think Hillary thus far has been taking that on? I think she has begun to talk a little bit about who belongs in the United States and who doesn't. She has spoken about that. What should she be saying that she isn't saying?
I can really only offer my views as a citizen. I can't say as a historian what she should or should not say. I mean, I think if I were her, though, I would be spending a lot of time thinking carefully about the role that rhetoric plays in the constitution of a national identity. You know, I wrote a piece a number of years ago, right before Obama delivered his first inaugural address, and I went and reread all the inaugural addresses. I ended up reading James Garfield's diary, because Garfield almost didn't give an inaugural address, because first he read Lincoln's and he was like, oh, damn, I can never rise to that. Like, he kept reading and reading and reading, and it was just this agonizing decision how to write an inaugural address and what it was that the nation needed to hear. And then when you read Garfield's address, it actually is quite wonderful. I wish I could remember exactly the line, but it's like that the country had been divided on the question of whether our Negroes are our fellow citizens, but we are no longer divided anymore, that this question has been resolved, and the Negroes are now Americans. And it's a quite stunning statement. It didn't get preserved. It isn't in the kind of hall of fame of ask not what your country
yes.
or, but it's a tremendous, tremendous act of rhetoric. Clinton can't do it. She's not,
no.
That's not her forte. That's one of her big weaknesses as a candidate. But I wish that members of her party who were not Bernie Sanders might think about the contribution it would make to the national political conversation, not to be damning Trump and blaming the press and talking about this, that, or the other Republican gaffe, but instead to think of what are the ways in which we can speak to one another and speak in a public stage in that front porch way.
Thank you so much, Jill.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Jill Laporte's a staff writer and a professor of American history at Harvard. She's the author, most recently, of The Secret History of Wonder Woman. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can find more political analysis and commentary from Jill Lepore and others on NewYorker.com or on The New Yorker app, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. Tell us what you thought of this podcast. Rate and review The Politics and More podcast on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Dubuff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.